Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, my name is Rachel Stewart. I'm a PhD researcher at the University of Kent. And today I'm talking to Karma Chavez about her book, The Borders of Age, Race, Quarantine and Resistance. And this is the latest podcast for the Sex Work and Sexualities channel. Karma, can you tell us about you? Who are you?
Sure. First of all, thank you for the opportunity to be here. I'm excited to talk about the work. And I'm currently an associate professor and department chair at the University of Texas at Austin in the U.S. in the Department of Mexican American and Latino Studies. So we're an ethnic studies department, and I've been here for about 5 years. And yeah, so that's who and where I am.
So what are your areas of sort of like specific research interests?
Sure. So I am trained in communication, specifically in the field of rhetoric. And so I am interested in questions related to social movements. I'm interested in issues largely about immigration and queer politics. And my work has historically looked at where the two of those things intersect, kind of broadly construed. And so as a rhetoric scholar, I'm generally looking at text and text also broadly construed, but really thinking about where, the public discourse around something emerges and what its sorts of meanings are.
Okay. So how it almost gets talked into existence. Cool. So why this book and why now?
So the book started many, many years ago, and I was several years ago, maybe close to a decade ago, I was an assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and I had this opportunity to contribute to a special issue of one of our big journals in my field called the Quarterly Journal of Speech. And it was for a special forum on the organization ACT UP, the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, which was, if people don't know, this direct action sort of pop-up organization out of New York and eventually went global that fought against government inaction and discrimination against people living with HIV and AIDS. And so there was going to be this forum that was celebrating this organization's history. And so I wanted to do something that had to do with race because ACT UP is known as an organization that largely was about white, cisgender, middle-class men and who just happened to be gay and then got sick or were friends with people or lovers with people who got sick. And so I was interested in writing about issues of race, and I was looking just, to write an abstract, put something together. And I just found this little quip about Haitians and the work that ACT UP did in relation to Haitians. And so I thought, oh, well, I'll do that. So I wrote this little piece about that using the archives that ACT UP New York has at the New York Public Library. And then, life happens. Book starts to go very slowly, not really working on it. But then I really wanted to get this project done and it wasn't quite coming together. And then really right before the pandemic happened, I finally was like, I just have to get this done. And so I talked with my editor. And so she was like, all right, let me give you a hard deadline. And I put it together. Well, then the pandemic happened, the new pandemic. And so I was finishing the book and the initial round of reviews were like, you have to change the whole book so that it's about the two pandemics in conversation. And I was like, oh my God, I hardly finished this one. But instead, what I decided to do was sort of bookend the project with thinking about COVID-19 and a little bit about what we can learn from the AIDS pandemic to help us understand the present moment. So it was sort of fortuitous that a book on the AIDS pandemic comes out as we're living through COVID, but it certainly wasn't intended.
Yeah, it must have been like really evocative, you know. So yeah. In your book, you discuss, and I really liked this phrase, so I have to ask you about this. So you discuss disease as one of many opportunities to express alienizing logic. How does the book explore this and what does that mean?
Yeah, so, you know, I was interested in playing with the notion of migration, because that's what largely my work is about. And I actually originally wanted this to be a book about activism at the intersection of AIDS and immigration. And that just wasn't coming together. But what I started to realize, excuse me, is that even when disease in general isn't about immigration, which it, with HIV and AIDS, it really was from the beginning. But even when it doesn't seem like it is, disease is always about borders. Disease is often connected to migrant populations globally. The book focuses specifically on the United States. And it also targets other groups too, of course. It becomes an opportunity to target other groups. And so I started to really think about the category of the alien, not as a legal category that people have used to describe immigrants, but as something that connected to a process, and a process that I think is deeply embedded, probably in most Western countries, but again, the book about the US, deeply embedded in the way that the United States functions, which is the age-old binary between the citizen and the alien. And so how does the citizen get produced? Through what I call alienizing logic. And disease is one of many opportunities we can find for a nation state to express that logic. So that's kind of what I'm trying to do with that term.
Yeah. And you know what? It's quite funny because all the time I was reading this and as you're speaking now, I got this real kind of impression of the invasion of the corpus, of the invasion of the body. And if you think about that sort of like American logic that would have you believe that the American body is that of a white male, then this kind of invasion of the white male space by this kind of diseased others helps kind of solidify that corpus, doesn't it? It helps sort of rationalize who's in and who's out. Because that's really what citizenship is about, isn't it? It's like who's in and who's out.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, in the U.S. context, if you look back at, say, late 19th, early 20th century discourse surrounding fears about immigration, there are all of these kind of bodily metaphors. And so not just talking about the nation as a body, but really the metaphors that get used to talk about assimilation. I mean, even assimilation is a term that was originally about digestion, but there's all sorts of digestion metaphors and lots of folks have written about this. And so that kind of, I don't know, double metaphor about the body and health is very pervasive throughout the history of these kinds of discourses in the U.S.
Yeah, I didn't realize how important the discourses about disease were until I started to sort of like read, you know, sort of like the works around sort of mid-century sort of discourses around prostitution are always talking about diseased, odorous, yes, and damaging, I think is generally the consensus. So yes, the book discusses how AIDS has always been in part about migration. Can you expand on that for us?
Yeah. So again, in the US context, and I think again, a lot of Western countries, but early on, the imagined victims, at least we think, or for me, I was growing up during that time, I was quite young, was gay men. And those gay men in the United States were white and they were US citizens and they were you know, they were diseased, and we saw these horrid images on the TV screen. And so the national imaginary historically is about gay men. But if you actually go back and start to read news reports from the early days of AIDS in the United States, when it was identified, it was, of course, about gay men, but it was almost as equally about Haitians and Africans. And in fact, in the United States, the Centers for Disease Control in 1982 named four high-risk groups for AIDS. HIV didn't yet exist as a thing that could be labeled. And those groups were colloquially referred to as the 4-H Club. It included hemophiliacs, heroin users or IV drug users, homosexuals, and Haitians. And so Haitians were the only national group, the only group named for not something that they did, but something that they were. And it had horrific effects, both for Haitians living in the United States, many who were immigrants, some were citizens, but many who were immigrants. And then for Haiti itself, Haitians living in Haiti. And we could talk similarly about the discourse around Africa, although Haiti was, in some ways, when you look back, even though people think more about Africa, Haiti was very present. And so almost immediately, there was concern about Haiti that it came from elsewhere. Then there was, of course, patient zero, the not real, but imagined, flight attendant who was traveling all over and spreading this disease to everyone he could, you know, sleep with. And right away, you have these fears about travel. And so the Reagan administration in the United States, as early as 1985, begins, even though they're not talking at all about AIDS publicly, they are beginning the work on a ban on HIV positive immigrants, really on the back of Haitians and Africans. And so this was from the beginning part of the fear around AIDS, even though it's not part of the dominant imaginary in the United States.
Yeah. I mean, I can remember in the UK at the time, because, like, you know, in the 80s, I was like, you know, I was in my late teens and early 20s when the HIV epidemic was really being talked about. And, in the UK, we got that thing about, you know, sort of drug users, homosexuals, hemophiliacs, and Haitians. But there was never any explanation. We didn't even know who Haitians were. You know, it was like, and Haitians. It was just, it wasn't even explained. It was just like, yeah, mentioned as like a high risk group, and there was no explanation. So it's quite funny the way that sort of the rhetoric spread out, but with no explanation. It was almost we all got the echo from America, but didn't get the explanation of why that was. So. Yeah. You describe yourself, and you mentioned earlier on that you're a rhetorical critic. Okay. How does the book explore the impact of the rhetoric around HIV and AIDS?
So what I'm trying to do in the book is, like I said, it originally started out as this sort of project that was just about the activism around AIDS and immigration. And what I eventually realized is that discourses of quarantine kept coming up. And that was sort of strange to me, because I was like, pretty early, we knew that AIDS wasn't a communicable disease in the sense that, like, you can't get it from breathing or exchanging saliva, even. It's not like COVID. And so it made no sense to me why quarantine kept coming up as I was reading these early reports. And then I started to realize, well, geez, even though it actually made no sense, it was hugely prominent. I mean, it was everywhere. There were all these discussions, and the first people to really even bring it up were gay men themselves. They had a feeling that this was going to happen, that they were going to be targeted with quarantine. And so as quarantine started to, I started to realize the significance of it. I started to dig deeper into the history of how quarantines happened in the United States, who they were targeted against, how they manifest. And I really started to realized that this was a prominent thing, and that many of these same discourses that have been used historically were being brought up again. And so that's just one example to say, I think it's really important to look at the way that things are actually talked about in the written text, not necessarily just the way we remember them or even the most prominent, but really sort of in a broad swath, because then you really do start to see in some ways what's going on and why it was going on. And then what historical discourse is being drawn upon. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's...
Yeah, it does. It does. And what I really sort of like took from it when I was reading it is that an almost invisible arm of the carceral system. So, you know, this kind of quarantining that does actually exist, but also kind of like a metaphorical quarantining, that kind of, you know, the putting outside, the kind of marginalization because of disease is almost like, you know, it made me think of like Foucault's discussion of people being incarcerated at the end of the 17th, 18th centuries. Yeah, sorry, the 18th century. You know, the people that weren't, you know, the marginalized people that weren't going to be really particularly helpful to the sort of the new industrial age all end up being, you know, incarcerated in all different sorts of institutions. And it's a similar thing here, isn't it? The outsider, you're incarcerating them without walls, but effectively putting them outside of the society. It's almost like Homo Sapiens stuff, isn't it? It's like putting them outside the city walls. And that's what really jumped out to me, because I was really interested in something you said about the example of Sullivan's Island as the sort of the Ellis Island of the sort of slave trade. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about that, because I've actually been to Sullivan Island and I didn't realize they had this huge history. So I wonder if you could expand on that for us.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know this history either. And so Sullivan's Island is in South Carolina. It's in the little kind of cluster of islands that are right there on the coast. And it's kind of a historic space. And one of the things that it is known for, and this has actually only been very recently that this has come in, and there's actually not a ton of historiography about Sullivan's Island, but it's imagined that, you know, as much as maybe 40% of Africans who were forcibly brought to the United States to be enslaved were actually initially processed through Sullivan's Island, which became this huge quarantine center, one of the earliest quarantine centers in the United States. And so much so that in the kind of macabre way, some people have called it the Ellis Island of slavery. And it makes sense, and the metaphor I don't think works very well, but it makes sense in some ways, because Ellis Island, of course, was also a quarantine center more than anything else. It's where, you know, people were held to see if they were fit to join the young United States. And so Sullivan's Island becomes this place where, again, you think about slavery and migration across, you know, the Atlantic, and people were processed, and then it just sort of left public memory in a lot of ways, even though it has this horrific history.
Yeah, because you know, like that particular chapter sort of kind of like kickstarts a discussion that you have about the history of quarantining against sort of like different minorities within the American context. So I wonder if you could, like, you know, talk to us about how the book explores that.
Yeah, so I did not intend at all to write a chapter about this. And eventually I realized that I thought it was important to really contextualize what happens with HIV and AIDS in the 1980s. And so what I do in this book, it's not a long history or a comprehensive history by any means, but what I'm trying to pull out are kinds of moments when discourses about quarantine are very prominent in various public sites in U.S. discourse. So sometimes that's media, sometimes that's political discourse, congressional debates, these kinds of things. And so I'm trying to pull out these moments when quarantine comes to the forefront and in what ways it, or in who it's targeted towards, right? So who becomes the sort of scapegoat? Who is causing anxiety? And of course, it's largely migrants, either already in the United States or coming from elsewhere, or it's Black folks, or sex workers, right? And so you kind of get, as you're saying, you know, folks who are already at the edges, but disease becomes an opportunity to keep them at the edges or keep them out altogether. And it happens over and over and over throughout U.S. history. And I felt like that was really an important thing to then use to understand why it is that it makes sense in some ways in a kind of grotesque way that even though quarantine didn't make any epidemiological sense for people with HIV and AIDS, it made a lot of historical sense given what the U.S. has done with people who have disease that is connected to marginalized people, that is connected to quote unquote deviant behavior.
Yeah. I also as well was quite sort of taken as well at the idea of the 80s when you've got this kind of like epidemic, you know, this discussion about the AIDS epidemic. At the same time, you're getting this kind of heightened carceral, you know, incarceration. The war on drugs is kicking off at the same time. And, you know, I was wondering if your book had sort of seen other similarities with that through history, because I know you talk about the kind of like the desire to quarantine, like Chinese migration.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's really an interesting point and not one that I get to really tease out a lot in the book, except to say that you have similar folks being targeted. And so where I didn't expect the book to go after I was writing, you know, kind of this rhetorical history of quarantine in the United States. And then what I had imagined is this would help us to, you know, understand the immigration, what happens. But the gap in there that I learn, which is what good research should do, is it should bring things to the forefront that you didn't anticipate, is that where quarantine played out was on the backs of Black sex workers. And so the exact same people who it's on their backs that the carceral system in the United States explodes after the Nixon administration in the early 70s. And so in some ways, they are very much parallel stories about how racialized groups get targeted in these ways, and it is this a similar logic, I would say.
Yeah, you get to target the population that you're aiming at in multiple different ways, don't you? You can arrest them for behaviors, you can arrest them for their health. You know, so there's all sorts of ways. So can you tell us about the methodology that you used for your research?
Yeah, so I think it's fair to say that anyone who studies rhetoric is very promiscuous methodologically. And a lot of us always joke that when we were in grad school, when we were in methods classes and trying to figure out, you know, what the hell this thing was, our professors would often say, well, just be brilliant, which, as you can imagine, is very helpful. And so the approach that I generally, you know, take is I figure out, you know, what concepts that I think are interesting, and then I just dig into news reports, I dig into congressional records, I dig into public speeches given by elected officials, and I kind of just chase stuff up. And then what I'm really interested in is patterns of communication about particular subjects. And so how do these patterns emerge? Who is initiating and perpetuating such patterns? And then I try to offer a reading of them within the context. And so in that way, I think for me, being a rhetorical critic is very much like being a cultural studies scholar. I don't know that there's actually any difference. Although I know boundaries matter to some people.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, my background, like my first degree is criminology and cultural studies. And they did really jump out to me as being a sort of cultural studies, like sort of like book that what we're seeing here is that sort of boundary being brought into discussion, boundary being sort of like brought into play that didn't necessarily exist before, you know, and that was really obvious. I also really liked something that you said, and it's a really cool quote, so I sort of going to read it verbatim. So regardless of the bodies they inhabit or are thought to inhabit, illness have a large discursive life intermingling with the physical course they own. And I just thought that was a really amazing sort of a quote, because I never really thought of, you know, a disease having a life. Mm-hmm. You know, disease having a sort of like a, you know, sort of being a sort of something in and of itself, you know, a sort of almost like a being in itself. Mm-hmm. So can you talk us through, you know, sort of like the life course of, you know, of the AIDS discussion, how that first sort of emerged and how the book explores that?
Yeah. I mean, I think AIDS, HIV and AIDS are such a good example of how disease takes on a life of its own. And I think, you know, Susan Sontag's work, Paula Treichler's work have really pointed to some of those directions and very, you know, early work. And I think I'm really indebted to that work. And, you know, what I'm really interested in the book is, I guess in some ways, AIDS is, that's not really a word, AIDS attachments to, all sorts of things, right? So it's attachment not just to bodies, but it's attachment to fears. It's attachment to deep-seated anxieties that long preceded it and that will exist after. It's attachment to the nation's imaginary of itself as made manifest in an array of actors, whether those be evangelicals, whether those be lawyers or legal experts, or whether those be politicians or journalists. And so what I'm really tracing in the book is how AIDS comes to be attached to this idea of quarantine, how it comes to be this sort of perfect storm for the manifestation of alienizing logic, as I call it, which of course alienizing logic is really just a very simple thing that's been talked about in a variety of ways. And I'm trying to use it strategically to bring different groups of people in conversation and the different ways that ends up playing out. So again, moving from in the United States, folks who are already excluded from citizenship, like sex workers, particularly Black sex workers, and then how certain people take this thing, people like Jesse Helms, people like William Dannemeyer, who were elected officials with a lot of power and a lot of homophobia, you know, sort of feeding that power, and use it as an opportunity to then attach it to immigrants, whether real, like actual people who they're afraid of, or the idea of invasion that has always been so central. So I guess that's the way I think about that having a life of its own. It's often very abstract, at least in the eyes of people who are perpetuating these ideas.
Yeah, I sort of like I liked how you sort of like talked about it being viewed as a sort of foreign sexualized disease. And you know, it struck me, what struck me as being quite unusual is that you know, it was a disease that seen as foreign and sexualized, but actually it was the first time that I think we have a disease that's a male disease, even though, you know, you're not, you know, like, you know, my understanding of the HIV AIDS epidemic is that, you know, the you know, disproportionately affects African women. Yeah, but we never talk about it in terms of the effects on women. It's always focused on the male, sort of like, you know, the men with the disease. And I thought that was quite interesting and quite unusual when it comes to marginalization, that actually who's being marginalized are sort of like a sort of gay men who in every other way would be very much part of the mainstream.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that is, it's true and not true, right? So of course, absolutely, men who have sex with men were the initial folks who were suffering, at least in, you know, in the Western world. But that ended up switching pretty quickly. And even though materially, you know, women very much became victims at a higher rate, disproportionate rate, you know, by the 90s, especially women of color, Black women in particular in the United States, that has never, the idea of attaching AIDS in gay men has never really dissipated at all. And I think, though, what's also interesting about that is that's why you had such intense activism that actually worked, at least in the U.S. context, is because you did have these men who worked on Wall Street, who were lawyers, you know, who were bankers, who were white and very privileged and living their best lives. And but for their homosexuality, they had everything. They were probably even Republicans, right? And yet they get sick and nobody cares. In fact, everybody is more than happy to have these guys just die. And so they used all of their resources, all of their white male privilege, to put it into the anger of ACT UP, organizations like Queer Nation, even some earlier groups, even groups like Gay Men's Health Crisis, which were focused on services. And I think that is why that worked, because then you did have white men who should be listened to in the U.S. society, who were, you know, acting up, fighting back. Right.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccoli, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah. And I mean, you talk about that later on in the book, how the HIV AIDS epidemic was also a kind of like a site of coalition.
Yeah.
You know, between, you know, sort of groups that you wouldn't necessarily have come together otherwise, you know?
Sure.
Tell us about how the book explains notions of alien citizens.
Yeah, so I'm building with the concept of alien citizen from Mei Nye, who's a historian. And she develops the concept of alien citizen, or at least that's the place where I first encountered it, to talk about, in the U.S. context, Asians and Mexicans in particular, and their sort of unique relationship to the U.S. nation state, in the sense that even if they've been U.S. citizens for generations, you know, it's like I'm like third generation Mexican American in the United States, but there's still questions about, you know, whether my family belongs, simply because of this relationship of being sort of forever foreign in the United States. And Asian groups, particularly Filipinos in her rendering, but Asian groups more broadly, have that similar kind of relationship. So she's talking about how some citizens are never citizens, they're alien citizens. And I took that concept, and I'm trying to expand it even further, which is to say, applying it to groups like Black Americans in the United States. And to particularly, again, sex workers in the context of my book, which is to say, here you have folks who should have the rights and privileges of citizenship, but for their work, but for their class, but for their race, and sometimes their gender, and sometimes their sexuality, and how that all kind of converges, there is no access to citizenship. They may as well be alien. And so I'm trying to think in the book about alien as a kind of coalitional positionality that can help us to see resonances in places where often we're not seeing resonances. So, in fact, usually we're seeing antagonisms, the antagonisms between undocumented immigrants in the United States and Black Americans. Specifically around issues of jobs. There's a lot of dog whistles, right, that get blown to the Black community about undocumented immigrants to say, well, you know, basically they're stealing your jobs. At the same time, a lot of the discourse for undocumented immigrants in the United States about why they should belong is things like, well, we're not criminals. We have good family values. And those, I think, are inherently anti-Black in their codedness. And so that's what I'm trying to do with Alien Citizen, is find ways to, you know, build connections where they might not otherwise be obvious.
Okay, that's quite interesting. I've never seen it that way. So you're talking about the outsider within, aren't you? And the sort of like the way these discourses are used in order to keep the outsiders out, but also to turn the outsider in on each other, you know? Yeah. So you talk really interestingly. There's a really interesting chapter about common sense and the debates around banning HIV positive migrants. Can you talk about how the book explores that?
So one of the things that happens, as I briefly mentioned earlier, as early as 1985, the Reagan administration, very much behind the scenes, was figuring out how they were going to create a ban on HIV positive people. I guess it was just on people with AIDS at that point, because HIV was still in formation in terms of what the virus would actually be called. And so, you know, the Reagan administration was kind of putting this together. And this is about the time when there's a lot of pressure on Congress and on Reagan to speak publicly about AIDS, because many people may not realize, but it wasn't until the spring of 1987 that Ronald Reagan gave his first public speech devoted only to the issue of AIDS. And there had been very little public discourse at all from the Reagan administration, even as they were working behind the scenes to try to do other things. And his Surgeon General, Sievert Koop, had put out a statement in 1986, but it was very controversial. And Reagan was getting a lot of kind of different information from the sides of his administration about what to do here. So the immigration ban, though, was one thing that was definitely going to happen. And so it is up for consideration in the Federal Register at the time that the Senate takes up a question about whether to provide resources for those who had been on a trial for the AIDS drug AZT, but now that AZT was going to be on the market, they wouldn't be able to afford it. And so Lowell Weicker, who is a Republican senator from Connecticut, he put forth on the appropriations bill that was being debated an amendment so that those who had been on AZT in the trial, they could still afford to be on the drug as long as they lived. And so Helms, Jesse Helms, the infamous senator from North Carolina, who was a, you know, hated gays, hated people with AIDS, he very, very conservative. He decides to add an amendment on the amendment, which was that it could only be passed if there would be a ban on HIV positive immigrants or immigrants with AIDS, and also a requirement to be able to have to take a test for AIDS before you got married, a marriage license. So he does this, I think, knowing full well that, one, he's legislating on appropriations bill, which is not what you're supposed to do. But also that the marriage license piece of that is probably not really going to be taken up. And in fact, it's going to be seen as kind of extreme, but he's going to be able to use that as a way to leverage in the ban on immigrants. And that is, in fact, what happens, because really, at the end of the day, all the senators end up agreeing, 96-0, end up approving this appropriations bill that includes the ban, that it is what's good for the nation, and it doesn't matter about immigrants. And part of why it was so important that it happened right then is in 1986, Reagan signed into law the immigration, it's called IRCA. So forgetting the acronym now, but it was an act that added employer sanctions and added some more penalties for people who hired undocumented immigrants. However, it also offered a pathway to citizenship for folks who had been in the U.S. for a certain amount of time. But what this was about to get instituted, but what the Helms Amendment does is it means that everyone who's going to regularize their status now has to have a test for HIV. And so many people, of course, don't end up regularizing who would have otherwise, because they were afraid of the test because, again, of the life of the disease. This becomes common sense that, of course, we should do this because what's good for the nation is what we should do. And this is imagine what's good for the nation. So that chapter is a really, honestly, it's probably a very boring chapter to read because it's an analysis of these congressional debates and how this agreement comes. But I did think it was important to kind of show the development of this thing.
I didn't find it boring at all. I found it quite interesting because what it made me think is that is the way that AIDS was being used as a way to kind of like put in more barriers between those unwanted migrants and those that could be accepted, you know, kind of like acceptable migrants. It was a way of kind of forcing people into those kind of like those heteronormative kind of boxes. Yeah, you know, and I just saw it as more of a kind of almost like a migratory tactic, you know, because we know how HIV/AIDS is spread, you know. So why would you be protecting the whole of America from people's like, you know, intimate sexual kind of, you know, sort of contacts, or, you know, it just that's what it struck me. I just had this image of this kind of really unpleasant little Southern Republican just sticking up more walls to keep people out. I was like, okay, that's what you're doing. And it was really quite interesting. It was really interesting. So the book then goes on to discuss the resistance of the alienizing ban. So can you talk to us about the resistance that this kind of like brought into play, how this happened?
Yeah. So one of the things that happened, so the ban really, the ban is put into place with virtually no fanfare in the media in 1987. There's a few reports. There are, you know, some of these immigrant rights organizations that, you know, put out statements because obviously they're upset about this because this is really impacting their ability to regularize people in their communities. But it really happens without a lot of fanfare. And I think in some ways, the only reason we actually get fanfare is because in 1990, the International AIDS Conference is going to be held in the United States. And that's in the ban originally, and it's quite complicated what the ban encompassed. And it was not really written that well. I mean, and it also put the decision in the hands of Congress as opposed to the Health and Human Services Secretary, which is usually where these decisions would lie. And it created all these controversies between the Justice Department, Health and Human Services, et cetera. But what happens is there's people that have HIV who want to come to the United States for this conference. So the International AIDS Conference is started in 1986, I believe. They're still one of the biggest convenings of people working on AIDS in the world. So they're vital meetings. Well, all of a sudden it becomes clear that people aren't going to actually be able to come if they have HIV. And so it's not even activists who figure this out at first. It's like the Red Cross in the UK that originally says, hey, we're actually going to boycott this conference because we're pretty sure the way your law is written, a lot of our people aren't going to be able to come. And like, that's not cool. So let's just put some pressure on the government in the US. Well, then a lot of other people decide to boycott. And then activists and organizations like ACT UP in San Francisco get wind of this. And they really take it as an opportunity to draw attention to the immigration ban and really to resist the ban itself. And so in 1990, there are huge protests as a result of the boycott, again in 1991 to a degree at the conference in Florence. And then in 1992, there's so much pressure that the conference then was supposed to be sponsored by Harvard and held in Boston. But there's so much pressure that they actually have to last minute move the conference to Amsterdam. And so that people can actually attend the conference. And you know, the truth is it doesn't actually work. All the pressure, the boycotts, everything else doesn't lead to the end of the ban. And the ban doesn't end in the United States until 2010. So for 20 years, basically, the ban is in place. And so, and there's not another international AIDS conference in the US, I believe, until 2012. So it's this, you know, huge thing, and people use it as an opportunity to respond to the way that folks with AIDS, particularly foreign nationals in the US, or even travelers, are treated.
It's quite interesting, though, because what I kept getting the impression of all the time that I was reading this is that, you know, like how we talk about othering, but that how othering sort of like gets almost like increased, like more and more people become othered. Like it's almost like the majority become othered as opposed to this kind of privileged minority. And all the time I kept reading this book, I was thinking, they have picked on the wrong people at this point to try and other. You've picked on a sort of like a section of society that is extremely well resourced. You've picked the wrong fight, you know, and that's what really kind of struck me. And then that was really kind of like important when you thought about, you know, how the book talks about the Haitian connection, how different it is when you don't have resources. And that really, really struck me. And because I had this image in my head of this American senator trying to push all these gay men out of the door, and they're like, we're not going anywhere. Yeah. But it's very interesting how you talk about the Haitian connection. So can you talk us through how the book explores the Haitian connection?
Yeah. So, you know, as I mentioned earlier, you know, there were the four groups. Haitians were one of these targeted groups. And, what I was, so I was, because it was mostly migrants who were being targeted here, although Haitians, you know, citizens as well, as I said before, I was really interested in the question of Haiti and how it came to be that Haiti got targeted, and what were the sort of nuances of how Haiti got targeted, et cetera. And so I was doing what I, you know, do with my promiscuous methodology, and I was going into these media sources, and I was seeing how Haiti was talked about. And it became very clear that Haiti really, other than in passing, Haiti wasn't talked about as much as it should have been. It was always there, right? It was always part of the conversation, but it wasn't, people weren't digging into the issues. And so then I started, like in the New York Times, for example. And so then I started looking at queer media, or I guess queer is proto-queer media, so like, some gay and lesbian newspapers and magazines, and seeing, you know, if I could find out more. And I started to realize a couple of things. So one, even though Haiti was always there, but just not really addressed in any kind of depth in, say, the New York Times, the LA Times, et cetera, in the gay press, some of the gay press anyway, Haiti was taken seriously in a totally different way. And so what I ended up doing is telling a story about the Haitian connection from the perspective of queer media. And so queer or proto-queer media, how, and I use sort of two case studies. One is a paper called The New York Native, which was in New York, 70s, 80s. It ended up shutting down in the 90s. And then Diva TV, which was sort of the media arm of ACT UP New York, and produced several episodes of what was called AIDS Community TV, related to when the Haitians, refugees who were fleeing the overthrow of Aristide in 1991, when they were detained in Guantanamo Bay for some almost 2 years. And again, the reporting and what the gay press was doing, I just found fascinating how much Haitian voices were actually centered as opposed to, you know, white U.S. doctors who were the experts. And, you know, the way that the complexity of the situation was just taken so seriously. So I thought it was really important to talk about that as resistance, talk about that as a potentially interesting site of a kind of coalition building, not in a traditional sense, because of course a lot of Haitians wanted absolutely nothing to do with anything the gay community was doing about AIDS, even though there was a likely connection there between the communities. So yeah, so that's what I wanted to do there, is to again show the kind of queer possibilities there.
It was quite funny because when I was reading it, like obviously I come from a sort of criminologist background. I'm a critical criminologist. And what I saw was the continued exclusion of Haiti that had been a feature since Haiti had like become the first independent Black Republic. And the way that it had been outcast from the sort of wider kind of like, you know, the wider sort of like sort of global community, how it, you know, I think, you know, it was paying back France billions a year still until really, really recently. And I just saw that as that part of that same punishment. You know, it's almost like you're pushed out, and you see it again. You see it again when the, you know, with the tsunami that Japan had at the same time as Haiti had. Like Haiti's still devastated, and you know, Japan, it was business as normal 2 weeks later. You know, and it was like I thought, okay, so you're still excluding, you're still being ostracized for daring to free yourself of oppression. That's how I read that as well. I thought that was really interesting. This punishment is still ongoing with like Haiti. So I thought it was because even like, you know, earlier on when I said in the English example, you know, everyone knew that Haitians were more liable to get AIDS, but nobody knew why, and there was no explanation. Yeah. It was just how it is, you know. Yeah. Right, so I want to talk about your conclusion. In your conclusion, you open with a quote from, I've forgotten his name, Peter Brime something.
Brimlow, yeah.
Yeah, Brimlow. Sorry, I can't read my own writing. Why did you use him? Why did you use him in your conclusion?
You know, so it'll be interesting to see how people react to the conclusion, which in some ways feels like this weird departure from the rest of the book. You know, I had always planned to engage Brimlow, and this is, you know, you get a little background on how the publishing world works, which is, so I wanted the book to be called Alienizing Nation. So Brimlow's book is called Alien Nation, and I wanted mine to be Alienizing Nation. And my editor very kindly told me that that was a horrible title for a book. And that you shouldn't have a neologism like alienizing in a title. You actually want people to remember the title of the book. So I you know, learned that lesson. But nevertheless, what I felt like I was still doing with the concept of alienizing throughout was really being in conversation with books like Brimlow's. And Brimlow's is just one of many that I could be in conversation with. So these very nativistic, you know, very racist, very xenophobic books that are anxious about the national body. And so because what I was trying to do with the book is really show how disease is this opportunity to enact alienizing logic, and that alienizing logic is foundational to the United States, what I really felt like I needed to do was kind of dig into a discourse that was more about the United States and about a particular idea of the United States, regardless of AIDS, regardless of disease, but to really kind of drive home the point about the depth of this logic. And so part of doing that is the kind of playing with the notion of the alien nation, alienizing logic with Brimlow, but then to show how Brimlow, who seems so out there to so many people, is actually sort of tapping fundamentally at what the quote-unquote founding fathers, Abraham Lincoln, as the example in the conclusion, really had in mind for what this country was about. And so it's me doing a reading of Brimlow and Lincoln in relation to each other to drive home this point. I don't know. I would love to hear what you thought.
Yeah, I was just, because I was thinking that at the same time as this guy's written this like absolutely horrendous book, is that you've got lots of other books that are kind of like around the same sort of time that are doing the same sort of like stuff, which is like, you know, increasing the marginalization around the internal alien. So I'm thinking this is the era of the bell curve and the era of, like, you know, broken windows. So you've really got to sort of like, you've really got to start looking at these discourses around disease at the same, you know, as coming in at the same time as these discourses around migration and criminalization. It's a kind of like part of a sort of like multi-pronged attack on certain parts of the community. And I was like, I've never really noticed that before until I read this book, how important a part that public health and the discourses around public health play in the evolution of the carceral system, you know?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
In a conclusion, you discussed the significance of coalitional gestures. Can you expand on this a little bit more? Because I feel like this is really important given that you're getting these multi-pronged attacks.
Yeah. So, you know, coalitional gesture was a term that I came up with in my last book, Queer Migration Politics, which came out in 2013. And in that book, I was talking about the way that in the United States, undocumented youth activists had adopted a lot of the tactics and strategies of the queer movement, specifically the idea of coming out of the closet. And so, you know, I sort of ask, is this meant to be a coalitional gesture, a sort of an extending of a hand toward another marginalized group in order to kind of bring them in? And I didn't really, when I wrote that book, I didn't think that much about it as like a, you know, a hefty theoretical concept or anything. But it's actually been a term that a lot of people, including friends of mine, have taken up and I think imbued with more meaning than I had. And so I've thought a lot about that idea, I guess, in the last, you know, 8 years, and thinking about what does it mean to extend a gesture of coalition, of solidarity, under what conditions can that happen? Who can extend that gesture? What does it look like? And so I am thinking about, you know, the possibility of, you know, alien being a position from which coalitional gestures can be extended, for example. But I guess it's just a way to name the embodied nature of coalition too, as a way that maybe some of the theory we have about coalition is often very abstract.
Yeah. Yeah. I get you. So what did you learn writing the book?
Yeah. You know, the biggest thing that I wasn't thinking directly about as much when I started writing the book as I am, you know, having finished it, is about anti-blackness in the United States. I mean, anti-blackness as a global phenomenon, but the particular ways that anti-blackness is central to everything that the United States does, and really thinking about how that plays out in different ways with regard to immigration. And so you have, you know, what Iowa Ong talks about, the sort of blackening and whitening of different immigrant groups. And I always kind of thought about that as metaphorical in a sense, even though I knew what she was saying, but she wasn't writing as much about the impact on Black bodies. And so the biggest thing for me, I think, has been to think in very material, very embodied ways about Blackness, about Black people, and about even when Black death is all around, how do you tell stories about Black livingness? How do you write, which I hope I do, in such a way that the voices of the most marginalized Black folks, whether that's Haitians who have been maligned in all these ways, or, you know, sex workers who are meant to be, you know, excluded to oblivion, how do we hear those folks in their own voices? And what does that tell us about us, whoever that us might be, that's not them? And so I think I became really attuned to that in ways that I don't think I was as much before.
Yeah. Yeah. So who was the book written for? What was your target audience?
Yeah. You know, I think I hope that people who are academics, you know, students who are interested in, you know, kind of, I think, unlikely relationships among issues and topics, and people who are invested in social movements and public health. I hope that they'll read this. I hope that's my main audience. But, you know, I was very surprised with my last book at how many activists picked up the book, found utility in the book. And so I really hope that folks in the community who are still working on issues of HIV AIDS, folks who are thinking about responses to COVID, thinking about racialization and the real impacts of that and how you can respond, I hope the book will be of use to them too. And I really did try to write in a way that I could have the widest possible audience, which is, you know, hard. I think hard, the longer you are an academic, the harder that is in some ways because you get more insular, but that really was my hope, is to be able to reach those two audiences.
Yeah, we get disconnected, don't we? So what's next? What's next on your agenda? What are you working on now?
Yeah, I think I'm working on a book about rock throwing at international borders. So, you know, I have a long standing interest in issues related to Palestine. And I have a, you know, my interest in the U.S.-Mexico border, which is longstanding. And I was really taken in 2018 when Donald Trump told the U.S. military that they should consider anyone who throws a rock at them at the U.S.-Mexico border to have fired a rifle. And he backtracked on that, of course, but, you know, he meant it. And I started to really just think about the ways that the throwing of the stone becomes the rationale for lethal violence, and throwing rocks as weapons of the weak, and kind of that connects people transnationally, transhistorically. And so, yeah, I'm kind of digging into this project about throwing rocks.
That's interesting, because when you say that, when I think about people throwing rocks, I think of it as a really young thing to do. I think of young teenage boys in Palestine. I think of David, yeah. Young David and Goliath. So what's Trump doing there? What, introducing state violence against youth? That's basically what that is, isn't it? Introducing state violence against youth. So yeah, you got that one for free. So
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, no, that's what sprang to my mind as soon as you said that. Okay, you're justifying violence against children. Right. This is your opportunity for shameless self-promotion. Who are you? Who is the book? Who publishes it? And when did you?
So you know, once again, the book, The Border of AIDS, Race, Quarantine, and Resistance, the official launch date, I guess, was June 29th, 2021, with the University of Washington Press. And I always say to people, and I'll say this, you know, to your audience too, although if it's too big, I guess I'd have to backtrack, but there's a 30% off code that I can give to folks. I used a lot of my research money to make the book really affordable. It's $25 US, and then you get 30% off. And, you know, if there's students who are really interested in the book and they can't buy it, you can always reach out to me, and I'm happy to get you a copy of the book. So thank you.
Excellent. So, yeah, we'll work out a way to do that in the blurb. So thank you so much. Thank you so much for coming. That was awesome.